patreon.com/thewalkoffpodcast. $4 a month gets you in there.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
There we go. Hey, Juan. Peter, hello. Thanks for taking the time, buddy. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me, guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course.
Couldn't have picked a cheerier game to have the group chat on. I know Juan as the Mariners fan is going to be insufferable today, so
you know, I'm not too mad about it.
It's probably best. We would have been too positive anyways if they had won this one.
You guys got the first two, you know, so
hey Zoobs, thanks for taking the time, buddy.
My pleasure, buddy. We have a one-year-old running around in the background. Not my usual. Our studio is being renovated, so apologize for the chaos. I'll try to mute when I'm not talking so it's not too squealy. I'm talking about you.
All right. We are basically ready to go live. So I'll jump in with the intro of today's podcast. Then we'll go around the horn, do introductions for everybody. We'll keep it brief at the start. And then the outro inductions at the end will be your turn to like plug your stuff, plug your podcast, plug your comedy albums, whatever you want to plug. But let's just keep it semi-brief off the top. Oh, there you go. That's a nice
Zoom's doing the full for you. The full Steph Curry here. I love it.
Very good. All right. I'm going to count myself in and then we'll get to it. So 3, 2, 1. And we're rolling. All right. Welcome to episode 206 of the Long Toss here on the Walk-Off, joined by maybe our youngest panelist of all time. This is very exciting. We'll see how this goes. We might need some cheerful distractions after the way today's game versus Seattle went. We do got a lot to talk to, some familiar faces, some new faces. We'll get to all that. But before we do, I do got to mention the Patreon, patreon.com/thewalkoffpodcast. Scott and I have some new Patreon exclusive content coming out starting this week. So MLB Monday mornings, you guessed it, every Monday morning, MLB talk. So we're going to be talking Bryce Harper playing first base. We're going to be talking sticky stuff, injuries from across the league, all that wacky non-Blue Jays content there. And then just to get really weird with it, we've got Dear Walk-Off Wednesdays. This is a Dear Abby style show. Work, family, personal life advice, of course, uncensored and unqualified advice from Scott and myself. So
if you need baseball advice, we're not the podcast.
Yeah. Definitely. Everybody knows that by now. Anyways, get your gripes in, complain about your wife, complain about your boss. We'll change the names and we'll have some fun with it. So that's new stuff on the Patreon. We've also got Q&A submissions for our guests, which, by the way, little teaser, we've got our biggest guest we've ever had. Can I say that, Scott? Is that accurate?
I mean, we've had some big guests in John Gibbons and Sean Green and Pat Hankin. And yeah, I would say this is the biggest one ever. So
crazy. So mid-May, that one's coming up. We'll announce who it is on the Patreon, and you're definitely going to want to get your questions in for that one there. So, okay, let's get that out of the way. Let's move on to the rundown for today. We got lots to talk about. Blue Jays, Mariners series breakdown. We're going to evaluate where the Mariners are at, their season prognostication. We're going to revisit the Teoscar, Eric Swanson trade, Danny Jansen, Alejandro Kirk, both catching well right now. Look at the AL East as the influx continues. Who's good? Who's bad? I can't even figure it out anymore. Lots to get to. So let's just start with this. Blue Jays blow it against Seattle. What? We're up 8-4 and Trevor Richards is coming into the game. I'm on my way to Costco at this point. I'm like, okay, we're okay. And then it's 8-5 by the time I left the driveway. And I see Anthony Bass is warming up and I can't even bear to track the game until Scott texts me when it's 10-8 in extra innings. And of course we've blown it. So let's do our guest panel interview introductions before we get too into that. I already forgot that. So Scott, let's start with you because you're the resident host of the Walk Off. You're in Kelowna.
I am in Kelowna. So I had shows all week here, Penticton on Wednesday, West Kelowna Thursday, a couple shows in Kelowna over the weekend. And I just want to kind of give a tip of the hat to our Walk Off listeners. We had at least one table or more at every single show. And I was taking pictures with people, Adam. It was kind of messed up. It's not what I'm used to.
That's not your style at all.
No, yeah. No, I'm trying to get out after the show.
But oh,
no.
Yeah.
As people are coming out to see me, I better.
By the time the lights come up, you're usually gone. So that's exciting.
Yeah, that's right. Stuff,
great. All right. Well, let's go from one comedian to another. Juan Forno, how you doing, buddy?
First of all, so good. Thank you so much for having me back on. Love seeing you guys' success. Your hair growth, Adam, is fantastic. The photo is real nice. Since the last time I saw you guys. Yeah, it was nice to finally sneak one out as a Mariners fan today. My boy Cal Dumper Raleigh, you know, going deep twice. We'd love to see it. So I'm excited to be here. On a high note for me.
Yeah. All right, Joel, the last familiar face. Let's get to what's going on, buddy.
Busy. I'm out at the farm right now. I don't know if you guys were getting those wildfire messages last night on your phones, but Alberta is really, really dry right now, and we had this insane fire last night behind my building that I actually had to run into, and that's why I sound like this, is because I actually like inhaled a bunch of smoke.
Because you're a hero.
No, I just ran into a fire like an idiot. I would classify it more idiot.
What were you saving, Joel? Were you saving your laptop or something?
He's like, this is gonna look so cool on TikTok.
There was nobody captured it. There's no footage of it. It's just this is the after effect. That's all you get. It was a bunch of grass, and about 50 feet away were these like 7 parked trailers with propane tanks. So I was like, I can't let that get there. So I was just kind of in between the fire and the propane tanks till the fire department showed up. So that's why I sound like this now. But that's what's going on with me.
That puts this loss in perspective, eh, buddy?
Yeah, you know, and that was also like happening during the Oilers win. So you know, there's highs and lows, right? And it's a series win, can't be too low on a series.
No, true.
Absolutely. All right, let's go now to co-host of Blue Jays Digest, Peter Vrionis. Nice to see you.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for having me. Really, really happy to be here. Without hesitation, I said yes once you guys reached out. So I'll be glad to do this anytime. But I mean, yeah, tough game to come on after, but it's been a good stretch for the Jays. Hopefully we can be positive today and then find some good things to talk about, because it has been a good stretch of play for the boys. And I mean, there's nothing better than baseball season. There's playoff hockey going on. There's playoff basketball going on. And I find myself watching the Reds and the A's that are stuck in the sixth inning right now. So I just love baseball. Anytime
it's
I can talk
sweet
about
spot.
It, I'm all for
it's,
it. I'm all for it.
It's the sports sweet spot, baby. It's the sports sweet spot, definitely. Oh, yeah. Peter, by the way, man, really love what you guys do on Jay's Digest. Really thankful that you're taking the time, man. Glad to have you on board. Looking forward to doing this more with you. Yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
And you're way better than that Nick guy. So,
hey, if he wasn't there, I would be screwed. I'll tell you guys that much, because he takes care of all the stuff that I don't want to take care of and all the stuff that I can't take care of. So,
he's your Adam. All that. I get it. Yeah.
He's the guy. I might be the pretty face. I might be the talent, but it's all Nick. Nothing gets done without him.
Every podcast needs a shit shoveler. I got it. All right. Let's go now to host of the Less Than Jays podcast, The Zoobs. Is that a Less Than Jake homage?
You better believe it. I don't know if you've seen the cover image. It's a Less
I
Than
have.
Jake album. Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay.
Layers of this game.
Let's start with this. What's your favorite Less Than Jake song?
Oh God, that ska garbage. No shot.
All right.
I don't have an answer for that. I let my co-host handle the music and the branding. Right. I'm my first of many disappointments during this episode, fellas. Get used to it.
Wow. It's sort of, I just know all the Less Than Jake fans right now are just spitting at their computer screens. So.
Yeah, Mill and Colin fans as well are vexed.
Yeah. Scott spits out his beer. Okay, well, let's get to it then. Blue Jays blow it against Seattle. I don't even know where to start with this one. Scott, I'm ready to DFA Anthony Bass. Is that an overreaction?
I think to start this conversation, we should acknowledge the fact that, yes, it was an incredibly disappointing game and things did not play out the way that we wanted to see it play out. And there were a laundry list of things that kind of went wrong. But besides this game, this team has been incredible. They've won 5 out of 6 games at home. They came in and did what they had to do, take 2 series in a row, sweeping the White Sox and beating the Mariners. They looked really good against Luis Castillo, won a dogfight last night where they had no hits until the 8th. It's been a good run for this team. Yeah, today was the worst. You got to think that Anthony Bass has got to be getting close to a phantom IL stint. You know, if there's ever been a rhomboid strain waiting to happen, this is the one.
Absolutely.
It was a tough one to watch. Honestly, when they came back, like the umpiring was bad. The umpiring was terrible in the first. Chris Bassett pulled a full on Steven Matz and flipped out in the dugout. Not sure if that iPad survived or not, but I know by the end of the game, I wish I had the money to smash an iPad because that's how I was feeling. But, that said, the Mariners, they're projected to be a good team. They're not that. They're still the team we saw last year, minus Robbie Ray, pretty much, who, bummer to you guys, won to see him go on the IL for the year. That's brutal. But, tough one to take.
Yeah, I think we got like 2/3 of an inning out of Robbie Ray this year, and he got lit up in those 2 outs. It's nice to see that the Mariners got one against you guys, and you probably should have went with Swanson instead of Bass in the pen today. So just rub that in because Tio is hitting like 213 right now. But we'll get to that.
He's leading the league in strikeouts. So
yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect. It's so good. The fact that you have more strikeouts than Cal Raleigh on your own team is a problem. but I also think, like, you know, the Mariners are what they are. And I think this is kind of what we expected them to be. They've lost a lot of one-run games. So it's nice to be on the other end of a close scoring game and a high scoring game compared to the last 2 ones between the Jays and the Mariners. So it's cool to see them actually push through more than 3 runs in a game.
Yeah, nothing like watching 10 innings and them go 1-0 and then it's like 10-8 in the next game.
We couldn't just Easter get famine. 1 of those yesterday.
Joel, let's go to you. What are your thoughts on this series? Are you positive? Are you feeling down? What are you feeling down about? What is there to be encouraged by?
Well, I'm still coming off of that Castillo game from last year where he came in and just dominated, and really you saw an ace performance in the playoffs. One of the videos that I did on my page was the Castillo when he went up and in on Springer to end the game. Like, I thought that was like a statement because Julio had taken 2 shots in that game. So it was kind of like, I'm going to bulldog into the 8th and then I'm going to like make a statement on my way out. And I always felt like that was like this, you know, in Toronto, having that done to you, then having them win that series and celebrate on your own ground. It was like that first series against Seattle, like you got to make a statement. You got to go out there and win it. So losing that last game doesn't really hold that much pain in my heart as opposed to taking that series, right? Because that's what we had to do. We had to win a series last year. We didn't. We went 0-2 at home. We won those first 2 games and said, hey, we're going to, you know, like that's beyond us. This is a different team. We have a different approach, and 2023 is going to be a different story. We don't know if that's the case, but at least they're coming in with that persona and that mentality. So I'm not really, you know, hanging my head even though it was a bummer loss because we were up.
If I hadn't watched this game, I would feel and be saying the exact same thing. It was only that I watched it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's I usually am the bearer of bad news and the devil's advocate when I come on, but I'm like, we tied our record best like opening start to a season, right? Like we tied our best. So, you know, we go back to the start of the season and say, hey, you're going to tie your best start up to 26, 27 games in. None of us would be mad at that. So I can't, you know, take one game and go lost everything, break iPads. I can't. So I'm good.
I wish to go to chat really quickly here before we go to you, Peter. And basically what they're talking about here is Bass and Garcia. Peter, where are you on Jimmy Garcia? Do you feel like as down as some people are on him? Because I'm actually not so down on Garcia, but I'm curious as to where you're at with the back end of this bullpen and Jimmy Garcia.
Yeah, I'm not too down on him. I've actually liked the stuff that I've seen out of him. He's just been a victim of the home run ball. He looked great in the World Baseball Classic. He looked great early on in spring training. Just got to get more comfortable. And I think this was a case of John Schneider trying to steal this game with his low leverage guys, with his bullpen arms that are struggling. And then you're heading into a 9-game road trip with all your back end relievers fully fresh, fully healthy, ready to go for game one against Boston. So it was a gamble that didn't work out for John Schneider. He tried to get through the game with Anthony Bass, who hasn't pitched in 5 days. I probably would have gone with Tim Mayza in that spot. Many other people would have gone with Tim Mayza, but I can't really fault John Schneider for trying to get through this game with the guys that haven't had much work and then regrouping for Boston. Because if you take a step back, you're happy with 5 out of 6 at home. It sucks that you blew that four-run lead, and it was to Seattle on top of that. But it's just the way it works. I can't fault John Schneider for the usage of the bullpen. The only thing I'll maybe go back on is not walking Cal Raleigh, because he's a part owner. He's got a little minor ownership of the Toronto Blue Jays in the past 6 months or so. So I probably would have taken a step back and walked him, but apart from that, I'm not really much of a bone to pick with John Schneider in this game here.
I guess one thing with the Anthony Bass usage, like he came in with a 3-run lead. If you're not going to give him innings with a 3-run lead, when do you put him out there, right? Like,
but sorry to cut you off, but my point is just that if you're on a major league roster, you should be able to get guys out, especially with a pretty comfortable lead. And Anthony Bass has been a high leverage reliever before. For whatever reason, it might be the popcorn, it might be his wife getting angry on the plane. He's not the same Anthony Bass that we saw from last year. But you should be able to get guys out, especially this feeble Mariners lineup that they fielded out there with no Julio Rodriguez, with no Ty France to start the game. There's no excuse. You had a sub-2 ERA last year. Go get guys out and figure it out, man. Enough pandering to these guys. They should be able to go out there and get out, and they haven't been able to do that.
Zoobs, let's go to you. If you want to weigh in here on the backside of this bullpen, you could touch on old Anthony Bass there and his struggles, and then maybe you can lead off the transition into Eric Swanson and how he's fit in nicely with this team, which will lead us into the Teoscar Eric Swanson trade.
Absolutely. First of all, I have to agree with Peter. To me, inexcusable to not go to Mayza here. ERA of 1.5, 3 or 4 batters are lefties. What are we doing? Like, I don't know what you're doing. If you're essentially the way they're doing it is Swanson is the new number one against lefties guy. He had pitched both of the last 2 days, looked absolutely nails. Totally get that. Got to go to Mayza here. I would have gone to Pearson over Bass. What is Nate? You talk about a guy, if you're on the roster, you should be able to get guys out. Where's Nate Pearson here? Let's have a guy who just rears back and throws it. I'm not a big Anthony Bass guy. He's one of those guys that when I was doing my season previews and looking player by player, I didn't really see the like what exactly it was that made Anthony Bass so great. Had a great year last year, tons of swing and miss. but nothing jumped off the page. Like nothing was crazy elite. There was no thing you can point to. Even somebody like Zach Pop, you can go, oh man, the sinker slider is elite. Even Trevor Richards, the changeup is elite. All these guys had this thing. I don't know what Bass's thing was supposed to be. He had a very good year last year. I had him pegged as a guy that was going to regress. Easy to say now, of course, that it's happened, but I just don't sort of, it never really clicked for me. I was like, what is Anthony Bass doing so differently? You're also talking about a guy who is in his mid 30s, a guy who's been a journeyman, a guy who essentially, we all know the word is fungible for relievers, has been decent for 12 years and then amazing for 1 year. That for me, big red flashing lights as caution. So yeah, I think it's a month of rope. It's been said the 104 win pace right now, things are generally pretty rosy. He's one of a few guys that sort of gets my backup. In terms of Swanson, oh my God, he's been humbled. It's like having bullpen Kevin Gausman. It's unbelievable how good this guy has been. Fastball splitter, not that complicated. I love it. I'm a very simple guy, not very smart. I like when I can see what's going on with the pitchers in like big bold letters. And when it's fastball splitter, I can figure that out pretty quick. He's been unbelievable. I was so mad when they traded Teoscar for this guy. Teoscar is one of my favorite players ever. He sort of represents what I like about baseball so much. A guy that came in, very clearly had some flaws and was like, how do you turn the flaws down just enough while keeping the part of yourself that makes you special? And I feel like he really did that in Toronto. They had a pretty good track record of guys that were able to do that in the previous generation of team that had success. So I was very sad to see him go. In terms of just like a general rule, it's like all-star outfielder for reliever in general, take the names out of it, is a dangerous thing to do. But also, man, how can you complain? Swanson's been awesome. And if you want to do the money thing, you can say it's Swanson and Kiermaier for Teoscar. If that's the deal, you get a little bit closer to being okay with it. I will assure you, Juan, this is the Teoscar experience. He is going to make you shake your head in right field. He is going to strike out for a whole month at a time. And then you'll look up and he'll have 25 home runs and he'll have hit 10 home runs in a month. I love him. I think he's absolutely great. But I've been loving Swanson. I think a real piece of what has been needed. We talked about it a lot last year. Swing and miss was missing. An elite reliever was missing. Swanson is that dude. Capital T, capital D. So I've turned around pretty quick on this. Of course, he's a reliever, so a month from now I could be having him in the Anthony Bass slot. But yeah, that's three answers to one question. Hopefully that hopefully that narrows it down for you a little bit.
To build on Zub's positivity here, I would like to just give a tip of the hat to Trevor Richards, who looked really good today, going two innings, a strikeout machine. His changeup is looking, I mean, it's always been an elite pitch, but he is using it so well and relying on it so heavily, and it's really kind of moved him up the rankings in that bullpen. And for a guy who struggled so heartily out of the gate this season and had so many people calling for his head, to watch him come in and just be so shut down, love to see it.
Well, myself included, Trevor Richards was the top of my list for hot seat candidates. And yeah, to his credit, has pitched himself maybe off of the chopping block, at least for the time being. And I again, not to harp too much on Anthony Bass, but this is why we do need to see him, as much as it sucks to see us not get it. Like, we have to figure out with Anthony Bass, either he's got it or he doesn't, because we do have a little bit of a bullpen crunch coming up. Mitch White is rehabbing right now. He's going to be on his way back. Nate Pearson, if he's going to continue to pitch competently at the major league level out of the bullpen, Anthony Bass is a guy we might have to be making a tough decision on and just cutting ties with. So we do kind of have to let him set his career on fire if need be, like, because otherwise, if we're not giving him opportunities, how do we get a fair evaluation of does he have it this year or not? Because again, 2 weeks ago you would have said Trevor Richards doesn't have it, let's cut ties with this guy. So it's unfortunate, but I do think that might have been a factor in tonight's decision. Is like, look, we got to just see what Bass has. Sure. Joel, let's go to you, Joel. Eric Swanson, Teoscar, a trade retrospective. I know you're a big Teoscar fan too.
Swanson's beautiful to watch. The fastball splitter combos is electric. The only negatives that I have, like when I look at Moreno, Lourdes, and Teo going, and Simeon going, it's more what they were and what they were doing as the extra the extra balance that our lineup was deep, right? Our lineup was deep with home run hitters. And the one thing that we've struggled with this year is consistency out of our four hole. We don't have RBIs coming out of the four hole. We've moved it around. Now that it's Chapman, it makes more sense. But we brought in three guys to try to alter the balance of the top of the lineup, and that hasn't taken place yet. So what I fear is that a four-hole hitter, Teo is hitting 200. He's got seven homers. Teo hitting 200 with seven homers on this team has 20 RBIs. That's more RBIs than the three guys we brought in replacement. So it's just like what we're getting is it's that lineup depth that I fear. And the fact that that four-hole hitter when Teo was on fire is a lot of the reason why you have to pitch to Vladdy. Having that dominant guy behind Vladdy is something that I feared when we lost Simeon and we didn't have that crunch of Simeon, Vladdy, Teo. You could pitch around Vladdy. And you've started to see pitchers not go to Vladdy because they feel like they can pitch to the guy behind him. So when it comes to that lineup,
they feel good.
No. Now Chapman is filled into that four hole spot.
Okay.
But for the first 17 games of the year, it was Varsho in the four hole. Sure. Right. So now that, but what I'm saying is that the moves that the team made were to bring left-handers on board to break up the balance of the righty heavy top four. But now we're back to a righty heavy top four. So that's my one issue with Teo going. Is that we were trying to do something with balancing out the lineup righty lefty. It is yet to truly happen.
Well, this has been the whole problem with bringing in left-handed bats is if we're bringing them in just for the sake of bringing in lefties, right? The idea of bringing in a lefty bat, you know, you've got the pitcher who's in a groove and can just get in his routine pitching right-handed hitter after right-handed hitter. But if he's just going to get in a groove by the time he gets to Vladdy and doesn't have to worry about a lefty until the sixth hitter anyways, then like, how is a left-handed hitter helping Vlad? Like if we don't have a hitter hitting in the two spot between Bo Bichette and Vladdy, like I understand that if we have Freddie Freeman hitting two between Bo and Vladdy, I buy that logic all day, but yeah, as it is right now, it's like, cool. We got Varsho hitting six and Kiermaier hitting eight or nine. I don't know how that having a lefty in either of those spots positively impacts the top.
Because I was the biggest advocate for bringing lefty balance to this team for like 2 years, right? I'm like, we're behind the curve. We're behind the ball, eight ball here when it comes. And that shift, the shift movement of banning the shift. And then we're kind of like, you know, we have to grab whatever lefties are kind of available. And it's a tough position to be in, right? The expectations of lefty balance being like righty hitter, lefty. Like look at core lineups usually have their core hitter being a lefty and even their four hole hitter being a lefty. It's tough when you expected balance, and it's a lot of it has to do with belt. And first of all, April is April. It's April, right? Do I expect these numbers to be the same? Do I expect Brandon Belt to hit .140 this year? I expect him to come around like that swing. It's not what you want to see of a guy who's 34, but I feel like it'll come around. I feel like, so we're just in a position right now where the lefties haven't given us that depth balance that we wanted. So that's my only issue of trading away the Gurriels, the Simeons, the Teoscars, because that consistent offense, righty or lefty, was consistent.
A great point in chat. We'll get right back to you guys here. Scott Carter says, the reality is how many top-tier left-handed bats even exist? Everyone wants them, and not like teams are going to easily give them up, which is a great point in this scenario here.
I have to jump in.
Juan, I wanted to go to you. This is exactly my point. You are, and I mean this as a compliment, you are probably the worst ball player in a very good ball player family. And I mean that as a compliment. No,
you're right, for sure.
So I want your input on everything that's going on here because you know baseball very well. So please.
Yeah, I was just sitting on the edge of my seat right now, especially because the last time I chatted with you guys back in September when the Mariners knocked out the Blue Jays in the playoffs. Sorry to bring it up like that.
You're a curse. Scott, quit scheduling Juan.
Yeah, right.
But I remember talking about the lefty-righty split. And I remember saying to you guys, why
focus on that when you're giving up a lesser hitter. At the end of the day, if the players available to you are right-handed hitters, then so be it. Go get the best player. Don't worry about this play. Get the best freaking player. At the end of the day, the numbers will work out themselves. And now look where you guys are at, right? Your top four guys are right-handed hitters. And luckily, Chapman's hitting like 380 right now. Mm-hmm. What was he last year? You know, thank goodness for you guys that he turned it around on an offensive standpoint. But you went into the offseason, and Joel, I remember you being so critical about the lefty-righty splits. And for me, it's get the best player. You know, obviously, yeah, if you have balance, that's great. And that's what you want so that you can't be manipulated by the bullpen. But at the end of the day, I mean, get the best player, you know,
unless I do think the lefty bats they acquired have helped this lineup, though. Like, I do think it has helped the balance in this lineup in the way that opposing pitchers.
Marshall's hitting 194.
Yeah. If I could jump in, I just want to say one thing is, I think the idea of like best player, it's really, I think I find it a little reductive to be like, you're just going to look at one thing, right? But Teoscar, absolutely, definitely a better power hitter. No question. Terrible selection. Not a very good fielder. Not a good base runner. Blue Jays are winning games right now by playing good overall baseball. I don't miss having bad outfielders at all. I don't miss it.
I'm with you, Zoobs.
Fly balls to right field, I laugh. I'm cruising. I don't even watch them. I know that the chat very correctly, Teoscar is the best DRS outfielder in the league right now, but there's more than one way to skin a cat. And I think, you know, we've looked at the last little bit. The offense wasn't the problem. There was some other problems that did them in. And beyond just balance righty-lefty, you have to have balance in approach. You have to have balance in skill set. Totally. Base running and fielding has helped them a lot this year.
And when I say best player available, I don't mean necessarily just hitting, you know, focus solely on which side of the box they swing, you know, that's a different argument. You know, totally when you start factoring in defense and base running abilities and all these other things, strikeout percentage, then that's a different conversation, right? Then that adds into the total player as a whole. But if you try and tell me that the Jays are better off right now with Varsho instead of a right-handed hitter, there's no way. Guy's hitting .194. It does not make your lineup better. Maybe he's a better base runner, but he's not getting on base, so it doesn't matter.
I mean, Teoscar did strike out eight times in the series, and Varsho had a walk-off hit, but that's a good point.
Let's look to what we do have in-house at second base here, because we do have a lefty and a righty. So I think that's where, like, a simplified comparable goes in, where we go, we got Whit Merrifield, or we got Kevin Biggio. And we'll do the Espinal conversation later. Well, let's just say, because Merrifield is hitting hot, plays a good defense. If it's a lefty-righty split we're worried about, should we really be saying, let's get Cavan in there because he's the lefty? Like, no, let's leave Whit Merrifield in. For the love of God, can we all agree on that, at least for right now?
Go with a hot bat. Just go with a hot bat. Who cares?
Peter, let's go to you. And what are your thoughts on this whole kerfuffle?
Yeah, getting rid of Teoscar Hernandez was more about the culture change. I don't know if it was about like lengthening the lineup or diversifying the lineup. It was more so about wanting to become more athletic in the outfield, wanting to just become a different baseball team, because for the last 5-6 years, we've tried the right-handed power hitter approach, an all or nothing type approach. And even when they were making those deep runs in 2015, 2016, that's what the team was constructed with. It's for those right-handed power hitters. And now in an ideal world, you want to get Dalton Varsho going so he can hit cleanup, because right now, if you put him in the four spot, he's not influencing those other bullpens to be matchup driven. So if Dalton Varsho is in the four spot, you're not going to bring in a lefty to face him, because he's not going to do any damage if you bring in a righty. So you rather play the matchup in front of him and behind him in Vladdy and Chapman. So you want to get him going, and I think overall value-wise, he brings a lot more to the table than Teoscar Hernandez does, and it was a good move. And Eric Swanson, if you look at that, if you look at it from that perspective, you're getting 4 years of Eric Swanson as opposed to 1 year of Teoscar Hernandez, and you know he's good for 25 home runs and 800 OPS each and every year. He does that in his sleep. But you needed a back-end bullpen guy, and that's what you got in Swanson. He's dominant. he's changed the outlook of this team. And I think Dalton Varsho has as well. I'd say the same thing with Kiermaier. They're a more athletic team. They find different ways to win ball games now as opposed to just last season.
I think it's important, too, to just bring up the fact that it's not like this bullpen has been shit in the bed for the last week. They've been incredible. I mean, in the last 15 innings outside of today, they allowed zero runs, right? They've
had It was bound to happen.
Ks. It was bound to happen, exactly. Yeah. And going to chat here, I know that Warren says, I trust only two arms in that bullpen. The others are shaky. And I think, and I know, Peter, you kind of touched on it too here, but Jimmy Garcia, he kind of performed this way last year as well, where he was kind of had a stint where you were just like pulling your hair out because he had good stuff. You know, even today, he was hitting 99 miles an hour. The Jays don't have a lot of guys in that pen that are hitting 99 that are getting so close to that triple digits. And he was one strike away from getting out of it. Like where we really saw the breakdown today was Bass. It is what it is. Like sometimes you're going to have games like that. I just want to remind everyone in the chat that like, it's not like this bullpen is on fire right now. Like it's a burning house. It's been pretty good.
It's been pretty good. Okay. Go ahead,
Joel. I was just going to say that like April is where you find out who your guys are though. Right. Like let's find out now. And what I see with this bullpen, which I didn't see last year, was like, to me, Simber and Meza are used more properly now where they were much higher leverage last year. Like I see that the situations match up much better for the pitchers and how they're being used. It's more of a, as opposed to Romano in the ninth, it's very situational how they attack, who's coming up, as opposed to the standard kind of seventh inning guy, eighth inning guy. So I like the way that like we're seeing a change, not only in the people who are coming out of the pen, but the way that they're used. So it's kind of like a culture shift since kind of Schneider's taken over. And it, I remember we used to one of the topics was constantly how bullpen usage and incorrect bullpen usage. And that's very rarely the topic on the show now over the last, you know, 120 games under the Schneider regime. So.
That Espinal error too, okay. In the eighth. Like I know we're jumping all over.
No, let's talk Espinal because I want to start the conversation with this and we can just get everybody's two cents on this. I think we can all agree at this point in time, Whit Merrifield's our best option at second base. Who is our worst option at second base? Because I keep going back and forth between Biggio and Espinal.
Someone sell me
on Espinal.
Peter, you want me to go? Yeah. Please. Okay. So Espinal, I was going to actually in my post game reaction video today with Nick, I was going to make a case for why Espinal should play if Whit Merrifield is ever not at second base. And then he goes ahead and he makes that error. So of course he makes me look like an idiot and I can't do that in the post game video, but I do think he's a much better option than Biggio. He's an auto out right now, and he has been ever since he's been in the major leagues. He had that bubble season in 2020 and he has not been the same player since. I think he has this long of a leash because of his dad's credibility and his dad is in the Hall of Fame. I think that's why he's still on a contending team playing massive innings and getting thrown out there every third day. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think Espinal has proven more and he offers more with the glove and he can play all around the infield. Whereas I don't trust Kevin Biggio to play third base in a pinch. I don't trust him to go out there and play shortstop because his arm is just not up to par. So I just based off defensive versatility alone, I'll go with Espinal, and he has shown the ability to drive in some clutch runs and be somewhat of a factor with the bat, whereas Biggio, I have no faith in him up there when he's in the box.
Anybody else? I'm open to offers on Santiago Espinal here. Please, someone talk me into it.
I think it's crazy that this is even a conversation. Espinal was an all-star last year. End of argument, you know, at the end of the day. Biggio hasn't proven anything, you know? So if you're looking, and I agree, Whit should be
the starting second baseman. And I agree that Espinal is not maybe not putting up the numbers he did last year, or not playing to the caliber that I think we know he can play. But Cavan hasn't proven shit. You know, you're talking about a rotational bench depth utility player. Why? Yeah, it's got to be Espinal. It has to be Espinal, unless you're trading him for somebody to fortify the bullpen, or, you know, a mid-level prospect that has a chance to be, you know, back-end rotation piece. Then sure, you know, the difference between Espinal and Biggio right now is not drastic where you can't look to the future. But yeah, if you're solely deciding between the two, is Espinal, and there's not much of a debate. I think the upside is way higher. Biggio hasn't proven a damn thing other than a hot week or two here or there. It really should be a no-brainer, in my opinion.
I mean, I'm not excited about either choices, but I think you're both correct, and you gotta go with Espy. It's funny when it comes to bench pieces, and this is the problem, is that with this second base revolving door, it's really hard to get everyone AB. So whenever somebody comes to the plate outside of Merrifield, who is also able to play some outfield, so he's constantly in the lineup, these guys aren't getting enough ABs, is my opinion on Espinal anyways, because he was so much better last year, and he just hasn't been who he was since he's kind of been relegated to that bench piece utility player. And whenever I see guys like this who do have a good season and then wind up in that utility role, man, does it ever make me appreciate, this is going to age me, but does it ever make me appreciate Matt Stairs' bat off the bench, and how it was just like, he was always such a threat, even though he never played, you know, not that Matt Stairs you would ever put at second or third or shortstop or anything like that. But yeah, if you're picking between Biggio and Espinal, I got to go with SB too, even though he did cost them. He did cost them. I mean, there's a laundry list of things that cost them the game, but he was one of them.
I'm curious if you guys think that there's a mental aspect with Espinal when it comes to, you know, he was in the All-Star game. The Jays traded for Merrifield after the fact.
I want to say that exact thing.
You know what I mean?
That was my comment, was that he's an All-Star. Where's the, like, faith that you go and you trade for another second baseman as this guy was just an All-Star?
He's putting up warp numbers.
Like, yeah, but they traded for him for a reason, right?
Yeah.
I know, but just to be Espinal and sit there and be like, hey, didn't I do something? Where does my leash come in here? But it's almost instantly second baseman comes in, and a two-way battle becomes a three-way battle. And I can see, Juan, how that would be a mental thing for Espinal to be like.
Yeah. I got to say, I'm with Scott. I got to say, it's not show friends, man. We're trying to win baseball games here. It's if you're slipping at all on a contender, got to upgrade the position. No question.
But he wasn't even slipping when they traded for one.
They wouldn't have traded for somebody else if he was still playing as an All-Star. Like, the second half of his season was not.
His numbers did dip in the second half.
They wouldn't have traded for another second baseman if he was still an All-Star. It's just like, I'm with Scott. I don't really see it with Espinal as like a guy that has, he's a useful player. I don't have him as like a guy that you can't find another version of. Very good defensive player, versatile.
Doesn't I don't really even think the Whit Merrifield addition was necessarily a shot at Espinal's role. It was more of a like, hey, now we don't have to play Cavan Biggio as much. Like, the job is still Espinal's this season. We don't have to play Biggio as much. We have a new backup second baseman and fourth outfielder. And things have just kind of gone off the rails for Espinal. I mean,
there's a great comment in chat here that really puts it in perspective from Grecian 5. He says, Biggio has 4 RBIs. Espinal has 5. Nuff said.
Doc, I love you, man. Thank you.
Dr. Internet.
All right. I can't bring myself to talk about this stupid second base position any further. So let's talk something positive.
Backup second, before we move on, backup second base is champagne problems, fellas. That's good living.
This is
backup
true. This is true. That's a great point. All right. Let's talk the catching position, because Danny Jansen's baseball bat has awoken. Alejandro Kirk looks good. Jansen's calling great games, for whatever that means. Is this the best catching tandem in Major League Baseball right now? Name a better one. Let's put it that way. And you can't just say JT Realmuto.
Well, it does sort of open up that if you have Real Mucho, you don't need a tandem. But I think yeah. I'll jump sure. on the thing and say it probably is. Yeah, they have no matter what your flavor is and what you like in a catcher, they have it. I'm a big Jano fan. I think he's been a real revelation. And Kirk is like stolen money, man. It just this stuff doesn't happen. Yeah. That guys like Alejandro Kirk exist. It's like bananas. So yeah, I'm all in on these guys. I love it.
I'd maybe go with Murphy and Darno in Atlanta. Okay. Those two guys are really good. I think Travis Darno's sidelined right now.
Yeah, yeah, he's injured right now.
Yeah, yeah. Sean Murphy's just been a revelation ever since he got there. You put him in a good lineup and you see what he can do. And he's just been so good ever since he touched foot in Atlanta. So I'd probably go with those two because I think Murphy's a level above Kirk and Jansen. So if I were to pick between those four, I'd give the edge to Murphy, but I think Jansen and Kirk are both better than Darno.
What about just Cal Raleigh? Jesus.
That's my boy. That's my boy. Big dumper, baby. I will say this, out of Kirk and Jansen, they're not even the best catcher in the AL East, in my opinion. Adley Rutschman, you know, not a duo, but I would take Adley over Kirk and Jansen personally. I it's tough to say, I hated the Moreno trade personally. I think there was so much upside with him.
He's hitting 300 right now this season.
That's what I'm saying, man. I thought that was a terrible trade for the Jays. And I knew that they had too much depth. Like those three are, all three of those catchers should be starting in the MLB, in my opinion, Jansen, Kirk, and Moreno. I just felt like Moreno had the biggest upside, personally.
Is why Arizona wanted him the most.
Yeah, of course, of course. But there's no way that you could tell me that you couldn't get some for Kirk or Jansen. There's no way. And maybe not the caliber of player as Varsho is hopefully going to be for the Jays, but it's all a process of weighing, you know, the value and the trade-off. But I think out of the four of them, that Moreno is the best catcher, even if you include Adley. But as a tandem, Kirk and Jansen for sure. Darno and Murphy for sure is a good tandem, but I think Kirk and Jansen right now in this current moment, you know, Darno's on the IL, so best commodity is availability.
I know going to chat here, Scott Carter brings up a great point about catching. He just says the great thing about two catchers is that the position is a taco shop. Of course, we call bad tacos injuries here on the walk-off. We don't want to jinx anything. So that's what he's talking about there. And he says you need to have that second guy who can play a bulk of the time. And you got to agree with that. When you look at the tandem that is Jano and Kirk, you know, if one of them goes down and they need to call up the magician they just brought back from Pittsburgh for Vinny Capra and need to have Heinemann sitting on the bench catching one game a week, you know, we're not going to be panicking like we would if it was already Heinemann and let's say a Kirky or a Jano.
And I think your backup catcher has to be a defensive whiz, in my opinion. Like nobody's looking at the catcher position for offense. You know, Yadier Molina was very rarely hitting 300. Ivan Rodriguez, like there's very few instances where you're looking at the catcher position for offense. You know, you want a guy that's going to control the game, knows how to work the pitchers, knows how to call a game. You know, so many people, I think it was Tony La Russa that said Yadier Molina could hit .050 and he would still be a starting catcher because of how good he is defensively. You know, even if that position is an automatic out, put him in the eight hole and then whatever, you deal with it and have them bunt with one out or however you want to play it. You know, so I think, especially in today's game, where there is rest considerations and there's, you know, night games followed by day games. And, you know, a catcher's never going to catch 162 games. They're not going to go on no Cal Ripken streak. I lean defense at the catcher position. And that's, I think, why I like Cal Raleigh. He's pretty good defensively. You know, he hit .210, but he'll run into a ball here or there and put runs on the board in a game. And that's, you just call that a win. And he may be able to steal you a game like he did today for the Mariners.
Another great example of that. I mean, Molina is a great one. Martin Maldonado has worked out pretty good for the Astros behind the plate. I think we can all argue the defending World Series champions are pretty happy to have a catcher hitting what is he, 131 this year, at 186 through 113 games last year, 172, 172 the year before. Yeah, like the catching position, if you get offense from it, is just absolute icing on the cake. We are getting offense from our catching position, so I will take it.
The one thing that I think is a little rough, though, is the fact that we probably this year expected less games where we start them both. We're kind of still in a position where we start one as catcher and the other one has to DH. So if we can get into a position where they really we're able to rest Kirk a little bit more. Right now, we pretty much have to start Kirk DH if Danny's behind the plate, right? So it's kind of a position where if we can fill out that DH spot a little bit better, you know, we're getting more production out of it then.
As somebody that was a catcher slash DH, DH is a day off. You're fine. You're good. You got to take four at bats. That's nothing. That's not going to wear you down. So if that's your best offensive
option. You're not swinging hard enough, Juan. You're not swinging hard enough.
Well, it wore Kirk down last year in the second half because he DH'd a lot. And I think he'd be much better suited if Brandon Belt could figure it out and he could DH as opposed to Kirk having to be Kirk in there after a night game on a day game the next day.
Nah, just tell Kirk he's a singles home run hitter. Never switch ever. I don't care if it's in the gap off the wall. You're a singles home run hitter. And on the bench. Don't even take a lead off, okay? As soon as the ball's hitting on the ground, just head back to the bench. That's fine. Take it easy, bro. You hit three
hits. That'll help.
Get away with that.
That'll help.
You know what was really interesting too, Peter? Because we did the math on this in the offseason. Yeah. We were talking about whether or not you want to see Kirky maybe DHing even more, seeing Jano taking the bulk of the time behind the plate just so that he's not worn down as much come later in the season. But then we went and looked at the numbers. Kirky hits way better when he's catching in a game. Like the numbers are eye-popping, the difference between what he's hitting as a DH and when he's actually in the game. And I don't know if that's just mentally he's far more in it when he's also calling the games, but hopefully he's more prepared to go longer. Like hopefully he's just more prepared to go longer in the season this year. Cause that was the only thing with Kirk. Yeah.
Yeah. I know when I play, I mean, I was third baseman and I hated DHing. I would get the odd DH day cause we'd play every day as well. 80 game summer schedule. So every now and then I'd get to DH and those were my worst games. I hated being a DH. I hate sitting on the bench, riding the pine, and then hey, grab a bat, kid, go out there and go face 85 on the hill. And that's not fun. It's not fun. It's you can't get into rhythm like that. And catching and hitting is hard. It's hard. I don't know how Kirk does it. I don't know how any of those major league catchers do it. But if he can keep it to around 100, 110 games, then I think he'll be much better suited for a long playoff run. And that's the ultimate goal, right?
I think Peter's absolutely right. I know in my experience, when I was catching and DHing, it's tough. It's tough to stay in the game. It's tough to stay engaged and then be ready for an at-bat after sitting for two innings and doing nothing for, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. When you're catching, you're engaged. You look at guys like David Ortiz, who that was his job. Right. He was just a DH and he learned how to do that. It's different. But when you bounce back and forth, it's a completely different ball game. And it's so difficult to stay engaged and be aware and know what's going on and stay warm. And so I agree with Peter 100%. You know, if he was
what a rarity guys like Nelson Cruz and David Ortiz were. It's just mind blowing that they could DH like they did and hit like they did and then just go sit down and just wait for the next time.
Well, there you go. Solution for Gavin Biggio's struggles. More games behind the plate. Look, I've got to take off here. I got my own slow pitch season starting tonight. So, Scott, you're going to take over from here. But I'm going to leave you guys with this to talk about as I wrap up and get the hell out of here. Alek Manoah pitched great against the Yankees, his first really good outing of the season, and then was serviceable this week in his start. Looked a little bit rough, but he got through the game. I think at the end of the day, the numbers didn't look too bad, but how do we feel about Alek Manoah? Are we back to being confident in him, or I just want to get a temperature check on my way out the door. And I want to say thanks to everybody. Peter, thanks for joining us. Zoobs, thanks for joining us in dad mode there. Appreciate it. But everybody else, enjoy the rest of the show. I got to get going and we'll see you guys on the next one. Scott, can you take it from here, buddy?
Hey, yes, Adam, absolutely. Before you run there.
Thank you, Adam.
Hey, Adam, real quick.
Yeah.
Swing hard just in case you hit it. That's all I got to say, bro.
Yeah. Swing hard just in case you hit it. I'm going to try out my new taco ball glove tonight. So I'm excited to break that bad boy in. All right. Cheers, guys. I'll talk to you later.
Bye. Thanks.
Thanks, Adam. Zoobs, really curious where you're at on Manoah. How are you feeling about the big man? Were you a little disappointed to see him take a step back in this game against the Mariners, or were you thrilled to see him bulldog one out?
Terrified, truly terrified. I said it before, I like it simple, I like it easy. He's a guy that even on his best days, he usually hits a guy and walks a few and has a couple innings where you're like, is this about to blow up? And this year it's blown up. Last year he sort of tiptoed out of, I don't know, a dozen starts where it could have gone bad and then didn't. Needs to have the velocity. Not that velocity is everything, but for some guys it is. And his numbers, when he throws 95 versus when he doesn't, are stark. If he can't locate the fastball, the slider is not a weapon. If the slider is not a weapon, he doesn't have a lot to go to, because the fastball is, you know, as I said, if it's not 95, it's not scaring anybody. And that's trouble. And this is probably going to be the last thing I get to talk about, given the way my son is acting. it would be lovely to have him be the bulldog that he was last year, but it hasn't looked great. And the velocity is the big concern here, for sure.
Peter, how are you feeling about Alek Manoah's slider this season? It has been hit and miss game to game, whether he's hitting their spots with it or not.
He can't locate it, and you
not working
right now. And for whatever reason, I think it's fatigue. I'm going to attribute it to fatigue, because he jumped in his first year from 111 innings to 196 the year after. So to put it into perspective, that's like asking Ricky Tiedemann, who threw 75 innings last year, to go ahead and throw 150 this season. The Blue Jays would never do that. They'd be insane to go ahead and do that. Now, we're comparing apples and oranges, because Manoah was a workhorse. He pitched in college as well. So it's different to compare those two guys, but I do really think it's fatigue. That's a big innings jump from year to year. And that was his first year as a workhorse in the rotation, 196 innings. He was very good down the stretch, but you could tell just from his first start of the year against St. Louis, the break is not the same. It's breaking about 2 inches less, his slider, the location. And you could tell when a pitcher misses to his arm side, he's compensating. He's trying to like play around with his delivery, and it's just not conducive. Problem right now with Manoah, it's fatigue. Maybe skip him a start. Maybe throw in a random starter in there. Something needs to change, because he doesn't look like the same guy. And I was banking on some regression. I wasn't going to think he was going to go with a 2.24 ERA again, but he's not a 5 ERA either. That's not who he is. I was thinking more 3.5, but it's a far cry from that right now. And I think it's fatigue.
Peter, to speak on the fatigue thought here, do you think that the pitch clock and speeding up his delivery a little bit is getting to him? Or do you think this has a lot more to do with the innings pitched last year and just kind of getting to where he was physically?
I think it has something to do with it. He's very meticulous in the way that he pitches. He likes to get in those hitters' heads and play with their timing a little bit. Sometimes he'll attack you. He'll step on that rubber, get the ball, and be ready to throw. Other times he'll take a stroll around the mound and take his sweet time before he fires off a pitch. So it has been an adjustment for him. And he is a bigger guy. He is a bigger guy. So that could also be a reason as to why the pitch clock is hurting him. But I don't know. I truly do think it's fatigue. And I don't know if I want to make the excuse about the pitch clock. He's got to be better, but he doesn't look right at the same time.
Joel?
stuff's inconsistent, which is really scary. It's the fastball that Zub's brought up has been my issue. Like seeing him throwing 91 to me is the scariest thing, because fastball is the most important pitch in baseball. Everything works off the fastball. If the fastball doesn't work, nothing else works. The slider also is not the slider that we saw last year. I just, to make my point different from what everybody said so far, I'm going to go the route of all of the pitch calm, the things that he's trying. He's been trying to call his games. Clearly that was a mental approach, maybe in the off season, that, hey, I'm Zach Greinke, I'm Max Scherzer, I'm going to call. So at the beginning of this season against St. Louis, he's calling his own games. That wasn't the right decision of a 25-year-old starting pitcher. You know, that's not your job to call the game. That's a catcher's job. Don't worry about that. Don't take that on. Then we had issues with them switching back and forth between who would call the game. It went back to Kirk. There were some issues where he got called for violations, and there were issues with that. Also, to me, that's thinking and a mindset that doesn't need to be applied to him right now. His thought process should be locating and hitting his pitches as best he can and just nodding along to what's being called for him. So this is a shocking thing to say right now, but I would honestly consider tweaking the battery for a game. Jansen has been dynamite calling games, and I know it's Manoah Kirk. They pitch the All-Star game. They always pitch to each other. But Danny Jansen is calling amazing games right now. So just maybe one game. See what it's like with a different flow behind the plate. Maybe try that out, because Kirk and Manoah haven't been on the same page the same way they were last year. And I've seen a lot of issues between communicating. Just the fact that he's trying to call his own games is a shock to me. There's no 25-year-old pitcher who should be trying to call his own games. And if that was his mindset in the offseason, then he was putting his mind and his efforts towards something he shouldn't have been.
So, there's such a skill to game calling. It blows my mind. Pitchers are trying to do it now. And Juan, I know that you spent years catching behind the plate. They're acting like this is a skill you can just pick up instantly.
Yeah. I don't want to cut one off. I got to go. Sorry, guys.
No problem, Zoob. Great to meet you, Zoob. Thanks so much. Can't wait to have you back. Everybody listening right now, check out Less Than Jays. Thank you so much, Zoobs. Take care of yourself, brother.
Love the show. Thanks so much. Sorry, Juan, didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, you're good, man.
Show, everybody.
Thanks, good night, Zoobs.
Guys. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
I think personally there's a lot to unravel here. I agree with you. I don't think a 25-year-old kid should be calling his own games. Especially coming off a season where he's introduced to the world, mm-hmm. A top, I think he finished third in Cy Young, if I'm not mistaken. Something like that. I just let him pitch. But I think the battery is not the issue and the pitch calling is not the issue if his velo is down and his slider's not breaking like the way it used to. You know, that tells me that the success went to his head and he didn't condition in the offseason like he should have. You know, obviously there are some bigger factors. If your velo is down 4 or 5 miles per hour and your breaking ball is not breaking by 2 inches compared to what it was, you're not the same pitcher. Your stuff is not nearly as good, and that makes a difference. It really, really does. It doesn't matter what you call at the end of the day, and it sounds like he's thinking too much. He's got too much on his plate. We've all seen Bull Durham. Don't think, just pitch, Luke LaLouche in there, especially with a guy as talented as Manoah is. Trust your catchers, whether it's Kirk or Jansen. It doesn't matter if your pitches are not what they used to be. Nobody in the MLB is getting beaten by a 91-mile-an-hour fastball. And if your slider is not breaking by 2 inches, that's drastic. That is a massive amount on a slider. So, and I think that comes from his legs. It sounds like he's already tired and it's April. There's no excuse. There's absolutely no excuse to be tired in April.
I was just going to say, and I know it's a tough thing to pinpoint and to even talk about, because you risk we've seen Manoah flip out about people calling Kirky overweight. We've seen him lose his mind over the body shaming of stuff like that. And so it's a really slippery slope to say, is it conditioning?
That's fine. That's fine. Body type doesn't matter. If you want to eat or whatever, or however you end up in that position, that's irrelevant. But he clearly did not take care of his lower body and his conditioning. There's no way. if he's coming into the season down 4 miles per hour in a slider that's not breaking, you are not fully prepared and you wasted your offseason. You know, you're
Peter, how do you feel old. About that take?
It's so inconsistent because on opening day, he was hitting 96 and he was touching 95, 94 consistently. And then the next start, he's down to 91 in Kansas City. It's a colder day. Maybe the air's not very friendly for pitchers. Then two starts later, he's back to 96, but the command's not there. So I don't know what it is. It's just weird. I can't say I'm worried about him because this is the first adversity that he's ever faced in his career. He was bound to have a rough stretch eventually. He came into the league and he was an ace right away. His first start was in Yankee Stadium, and he already strikes out Aaron Judge and he owns that loaded Yankees lineup. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. I think he's just hit a rough patch right now. It could be attributed to fatigue. It could be a multitude of factors. Maybe the best thing for him is to skip a start or two, get back right mentally, throw a couple of bullpens, know what's working, know what's not working, and get back at it.
I do think that's actually okay.
Yeah, so do I. And I think it is a great point, Peter, about the fact that he has never experienced an obstacle in his career. And forget about big league career. He hasn't experienced an obstacle since he started pitching professional baseball. So, I mean, the last time he's had to recalibrate or fix something with his game, he was in college. He was in high school. Like, so I agree. I feel good about Alek Manoah, but I am nervous about the next month.
It's fair. It's fair to say. And I'm still not at that point. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably say 3, just because of how good he's been. Every starter hits rough patches. Even Justin Verlander has had stretches where he doesn't look good. So I'll give it some time. It's only been a few starts. And I feel like we often say with Manoah, oh, he didn't have his best stuff today, or he didn't look too sharp, but you still look at the box score and he gives you 6 innings and 2 earned runs, and he gives you a chance to win the game. So if it can step doing his entire career, then I think he'll be fine.
I'm curious if you guys, and you will, the three of you will know better than I do. I think there's 3 of you left at this point. I think you guys will know better, but do you think that there's maybe an issue with overdevelopment? I know that Toronto has a hard time producing starting caliber pitchers. Look at Peterson, look at, you know, all these guys that you had in the system that were supposed to be absolute aces. Do you think that maybe there's just too much going on? Like, maybe the coach has just got to let him pitch instead of trying to improve? Because let's be honest, you guys have not been the best at developing pitchers.
Joel, thoughts?
I'm all for the old school, like almost the Japanese method of let kids pitch. Now we're all onto like computer designed whiff programs to jack up your spin rate, and everything is this mechanical pursuit of a number that says that you're a good pitcher. But the only thing that says that you're a good pitcher is getting outs when you're on the mound, right? That's the only thing that defines whether a good pitcher is a good pitcher or not. So to play to your point, Juan, I'm worried that pitching has become this scientific pursuit as opposed to the art of knowing what's in front of you, knowing how that guy hits, how to locate what you need to locate. And it's like the Bull Durham, stop being such a fascist, you know, let's be more democratic and throw some ground balls. Like that kind of sums it up right there, is that I'm worried that it's a little bit too, and also the pursuit of 102 miles an hour isn't, the elbow only can withstand, the human elbow can withstand 39.5 pounds per square inch on that ulnar collateral ligament. That's an evolutionary, that's the limit of the arm. So anybody who throws 95 plus is a fluke. That's a fluke. Our arms should not be able to do that. So if you take kids and you constantly pursue 102 miles an hour, arms are just going to snap and you're never going to develop any pitchers. So I'm kind of all for you with the, you got to pitch, right? Stop pursuing some sort of spin rate number, 101 miles an hour to define you as a pitcher.
And I think the perfect example is a guy like Tim Lincecum. Look at how he pitched, and now everybody was against his mechanics, but he had a couple Cy Youngs. So
yeah,
if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So, and who knows? We don't know behind the scenes. We don't know what the conversations are between P. Walker and Manoah and what they're trying to change. And if they think that they can make him even better than what he was last season, who knows? But there is got to be some concern that maybe they're just tinkering too much. Yeah, who knows? But I agree with you, Joel. Like, let a guy pitch. If he's pitched this way his entire life and he's been successful and that's what's gotten him here, and it's, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Go ahead, Joel.
The one thing I wanted to say was just every single thing that every one of us has mentioned is all on top of him, on top of Twitter beefs with Alex Verdugo, calling Gerrit Cole the biggest cheater in baseball, and like taking it on, right? Like all of these things are on his plate. He has an incredibly full plate, and I feel like every single one of them is eating at him a little bit. And maybe all of everything is to blame as opposed to one singular thing is to blame, right? So yeah, it's just,
it could be some immaturity peeking through with the success. Yeah. You know, look at a guy like Stroman. You know, he was supposed to be the guy and was the guy for a little while, but there's a reason they traded him, you know, and now he's been a middle tier. He's off to a
pretty
start this year, but Stroman is a perfect example of a guy that, you know, started worrying about other things other than just being who he is and letting his work show.
I think I'm with you a little bit on the overcoaching too, because it's either it's one extreme or another with Pete Walker. Because you look at some of the reclamation projects, you see, for example, I'll give Robbie Ray. He won a Cy Young after being god awful in Arizona. And then you look at Steven Matz, got himself paid after that good year in Toronto. And then Jose Barrios inks that big extension, and now he's not the same guy that he was in Minnesota. And you could say the same thing with Kikuchi. He's not the same guy that he was. So I don't know. Maybe they are trying to tinker too much with these guys and thinking that they can change the way that their careers have progressed and gone up to this point. But I don't know. It's I could be a little bit of overcoaching, but I think Alec Manoah knows what makes him successful, and he's just got to get back to that at the end of the day.
And all of this said, Alec Manoah still has a 1.5 ERA over his last two starts. So it's tough to really, you know, like we did just dissect him for the last 10 minutes of what's wrong with him, and he's looked all right. I know starting pitching has been the strong point of this team over the last 3 weeks, and you'd love to see it continue. To everyone in chat right now, thank you so much. If you've just joined us, I know there's a couple new people here. We've got almost 60 people watching. If you've yet to hit that like button, would love to see you do it. We've got Peter from Jay's Digest, Hey Commie from TikTok, and comedian who was based out of Seattle, now in Portland, Mariners fan Juan Forno. So what we'll do now here, because we are getting long in the tooth, we got about 45 minutes left. We are going to talk the AL East and where we think that's all going to shake out as we look at this division. And it's just, honestly, it's insane right now to see New York and Boston at the bottom of the division and still 15 and 14 and above 500. I think I actually saw that the AL East was pushing a 700 win percentage, like for all the teams, which is like mind blowing. So we are going to talk AL East, but let's get into a topic. I know this is what we do every Sunday, is we get our panelists to bring a topic that they want to talk about. So let's dig into a topic here. Peter, do you want to start off here, bud?
I wanted to go Blue Jays related, but Juan's a Mariners fan. So maybe I'll just go more general here. I want to talk a little bit about the Diamondbacks and what they've been doing. They're first place in the NL West. I love that young team. I have a lot of their young players on my fantasy squad as well. Corbin Carroll, favorite for Rookie of the Year. So I'm just going to ask you guys, what are you thinking of the Diamondbacks? Are they for real? What do they need to do to become for real? Or is it even a possibility for this season? It's a pretty loaded question, but if you want to try and tackle it, go ahead.
I love this question. Unless one of you want to jump in here, I'll start with this.
Go for it. Get it.
All right. So I feel very similar to Arizona as I do to Baltimore, which is that they are going to be a very, very good team for the next half a decade, maybe more. The way that the Diamondbacks have built this team, the way they've gone out and got these young, like, again, Terrell in center field and Moreno at catcher, like, these are two positions that are incredibly difficult to find superstars at. And the fact you have two young studs that the ceiling is limitless almost is incredible. However, I do think that Arizona is going to take another year of development to really take that next step. And when I say next step, I mean be a competitor for that wild card spot. I'm not saying it's impossible for the Orioles or the Diamondbacks to be that team this year, but I would be absolutely shocked personally. It is so tough for a young team to keep it up for 162 games. They're going to run into obstacles. They're going to run into losing streaks. They're going to run into pitching problems. They're going to have injuries. How will this young core with the Diamondbacks deal with it? Probably like most young cores do, and buckle a little bit. Now, that said, this experience of this year is going to be paramount for them moving forward. And I really do think that come 2024, we're going to be talking about, holy crap, Arizona is competing with the Dodgers for top spot in that NL West.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, Juan, let's go to you, bud.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I honestly think that Arizona is going to be a wild card team this year, but probably a wild card exit. In my opinion, but their roster construction right now is great. I loved, like I said earlier, the Moreno trade. I'm a big Moreno fan. I think he does a lot of things right. And then Carroll, yeah, that's a stud. And you lock up a center fielder and a catcher. Those are two very, very important positions. I think they're competing with some powerhouses that maybe haven't shown that they're powerhouses so far this season, in the Padres and the Dodgers. So I think they are in a tough division, much like the Orioles, where, you know, they're showing out right now, but it's still early and the season gets long and you get into, you know, July and August before that playoff push. And I think that's when they'll start to buckle a little bit. But their future is bright. And I don't think Arizona went into this season thinking, you know, World Series. I think they were thinking, you know, one year, one step towards being a World Series contender. And I think they're doing all the right things. So I got to agree with you. Baltimore, Arizona right now, they look like they have a bright future ahead of them. But, you know, it's still a little early. It's when the Blue Jays made that, you know, wild card in the shortened season. You know, they're on the right path. And I think they're going to be okay. But I project a wild card exit for the Diamondbacks this year.
In chat here, we have Jason Austin piping up here. He says, being a Dodger fan, I've watched lots of D-backs and NL West. Fun team to watch. Great young talent. Depth isn't there to contend beyond the wild card. Their pen is average at best.
I think completely accurate. They're getting their building blocks like Moreno and Carroll right now, and then they can work on the depth. I think
Zach Gallen too. We gotta give a shout out to
my God. Gallen is just unreal.
He's so good.
Yeah,
he's so good, and he's under team control for another 3 years, I believe.
Amazing.
Three.
They put the wrong guy on the cover of the show.
Joel, Diamondbacks, where are you at?
That's you guys all said my feelings. I feel like they're Baltimore last year, right? You said, is that what you meant by Baltimore? Like Baltimore and that rise that you saw last year?
I more feel like they're the same this year. I don't believe in Baltimore in 2023. That said, I do believe Baltimore is going to be a thorn in the side of AL East teams for the next decade. I just don't think that – I don't believe in their pitching, man. They're starting
I don't believe in Baltimore believe in that it. Division.
Yeah.
If it was other division.
The Baltimore comparison, to me, I'm feeling more of that Baltimore last season that came kind of – 86 wins, you know, came up and said, hey, we're a baseball team. To me, that's where I feel like Arizona is this year. Endless compliments towards Gallen, though. That innings streak that he's on right now is just ridiculous. It's still going, right? Is it what, 29?
Yeah, it's still going.
It's insane. And they've been a fourth place-ish team for a while now. So it's nice to see them make this turnaround. The core pieces of youth being, you know, Gallen, Carroll, and Moreno, that's what your desire is, to build a future contender. Like you said, Scott, for 10 years, you've got guys who are 22, 23, 25, you can, and under team control for so long, that's the core. And that's, they're going to be competitive. It's the Dodgers reloading, right? This is the kind of the year that they didn't do anything. So this is a kind of maybe a sneaky year to say, hey, let's compete a little bit this year. We'll see what the Dodgers do next year, but future's bright. Future's bright for us.
And yeah, and they have so many prospects in the wings as well. And Jordan Lawler, one of the top shortstop prospects, who's not too far away from the major leagues. They have this starter, his name is Fott, and he's going to come up now and replace Madison Bumgarner, who is in that rotation, and they DFA'd him not long ago. So I think they're not too far away. I could see them winning maybe 86 games this year and sneaking into a wild card spot. And you never know. Once you get in there, they got some decent bullpen arms in Dre Jameson. They got Andrew Chafin, who's pretty underrated reliever. They might look to flip at the deadline for even more prospects. So, man, they're on the right track. They're such a fun team to watch. And I suggest each and every one of you that are in this chat, if you're looking for a team to watch on the West Coast, it's the Diamondbacks, because they're legit, man. They are legit.
Great topic. Love it. I know Juan's got to dip out here about 15 minutes before the end of the show, so we'll get to your topic here, buddy, and then get into some AL East talk.
Yeah, I would love to talk about your guys' thoughts on trash talk in sports. I think it was some with the NBA playoffs going on right now. I don't know if you guys are aware of the Dylan Brooks situation. Dylan Brooks plays for the Memphis Grizzlies. They were the 2 seed, and talk shit to LeBron James, who is the all-time leading scorer in the history of ever in basketball. And the Lakers in the 7 seed, and the Lakers whooped that ass. They won in 6, and you could see the motivation based off of Dylan Brooks's trash talk. And I think maybe it goes back to even Manoah a little bit and the Garrett Cole situation. Are you guys pro trash talk in sports, or are you think you should just shut up and play?
I like it. I just hate when it's directed towards me. For whatever reason, I can't handle it. I don't know. Maybe I don't have the thickest of skin when I play ball, but I hated trash talk. I just kept my mouth shut and played.
Peter, just out of curiosity, what was some trash talk you dealt with that just like rattled you?
Oh, dude, you have no idea, man. You have no idea. So I'm the only, I grew up in Quebec, and it's mostly French. I'm one of the only English guys when I played, and not too many look like me with a beard and darker skin. So I think you could paint the picture.
You had a target
yourself
on your back. Okay. Yeah,
it wasn't even the other teams at times. It was mostly my own teammates as well. So I went about my business and went from there. But yeah, I'm not the greatest at dealing with trash talk, but I like it when it's amongst pro athletes and it's done in good faith. It's fun. It's fun to watch.
Yeah. How about you, Joel? Where are you at on this?
I think there's a line, right? Like I don't mind you pumping your chest and being like big on a moment. Baseball is weird because baseball's 100 years of like hit a home run and put your head down, right? And we're trying to kind of get over that and try to make it more of a fun game in the last 15 years. So it's kind of a cultural change. To me, when you trash talk, you're opening yourself up to have it shoved right back down your throat, right? So to me, some of the greatest moments are opening your mouth, and then the other team's performance speaks so much louder than any words you could have ever said. So, you know, it's like, you might talk some shit, but you're opening yourself up for a hell of a lot of shit to be thrown back at you for much longer if you're not right about that. Like you said, with the Grizzlies and the Lakers, right? Like the shit that you can talk after beating them, as opposed to the shit that you talk when you expect to beat somebody, right? That's so much better shit to talk anyway. So, but yeah, there's a line to it. There's things that you shouldn't say, like the shit that was probably said to Peter when he was playing.
No, it's nothing. It was nothing egregious, but like, there was one thing I'll name off the top of my head. A lot of people call me Bert from Sesame Street. They say I look like Bert from Sesame Street, and doesn't get into your head, you know, but it's that friendly fire that kind of like, why would he say that to me, man? And then you grip the bat a little bit tighter. You grip the bat a little bit tighter in the box, and then you whiff on strike 3 and feel stupid walking back to the dugout. So it's just when it's in good faith like that, and it's not like attacking personality or anything crazy like that, then I like it. It just adds a different element to the game, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny because I like the
fans, right? Like,
No, go ahead.
All I was saying is, like, you don't want with the fans talking trash to the players, right? Like, there's a line there too. There's things that you can say, rile them up, and everybody's going to be happy for it. But then you can say things that are too far. And it's a situation that you want fans to, we're putting in a situation where we can be so much closer to the players now. So, and you don't want, that's, you know, that's a responsibility that's been put on the fan base now, especially being a fan base that represents an entire country as opposed to just a city. Right. So it's like, you know, it's, there's a line. There's a line.
It's funny because I do love trash talk. I really do. That said, when it backfires, I hate trash talk. Like, my goodness. Like, when Vladdy came out and was like, last year was the trailer, this year is the movie, I was like, yes, buckle up, Yankees fans. And then last year happened, and then I was like, oh man, and now this keeps getting thrown in our face, right? Or like,
it's a nightmare. It was a nightmare movie.
It's a nightmare. Exactly.
I love the competitiveness of trash talk, as long as it's, that's what it is. As long as it's not personal, right? Like Joel and Peter said, like, don't attack, you know, somebody's family or their appearance, or that's just, I think that's trash. But I love when you're competitive and you want to talk a little bit of shit. I'll never forget, there was one time in high school, my senior year, runner on first and third, two outs. I was on deck, and they chose to intentionally walk the four hitter. I was in the five hole. And I was like, all right. Well, I looked at the coach. He was sitting on the bucket outside the dugout. I was like, dude, you just fucked up. Like, you shouldn't have done that. And he was a college player at the time when I was in high school. And he was like, all right, here we go. And they started me off with a curveball first pitch. And I was like, okay, if this is what it's going to be. I ended up hitting a grand slam, and there's no more satisfying. Like, hey, you chose not to face that guy. You chose to face me. I'm going to fucking stick it to you. But it doesn't always work out that way. You got to prepare.
It doesn't always work out. No.
You got to prepare for those consequences when it doesn't work out that way. But I think it adds fun competitiveness.
When I caught too, I used to catch quite a bit in junior baseball, and we'd get into it. I remember in the COVID year, there were no umpires behind you, right? So they would be at the pitcher's mound, and oh, you should hear some of the things that went on there and in between to myself and those batters in the box. And I remember there was this one guy, after every pitch, he would ask me, well, what was that? Was that a changeup? And finally, I just wouldn't say anything. Like, I'm not going to tell you what my pitcher's throwing. Like, I don't want you to know his repertoire, how it's breaking and all that. And finally, I told him, like, dude, if you ask me one more time, man, you won't even have to ask me what pitch is coming, because it'll go right in between your two eyes. And then we just, like, he got pissed. He called time. He looked out to the mound and called time. And we started getting into it, and it was funny. But trash talking's fun, man. It's fun when it's on the field and it's in good nature. It's just it's good. It's in good spirit, man. I like it.
Just keep it competitive and not personal.
Yeah, there you go.
Great topic, Juan. All right, let's get into the AL East, because I know you got to get out of here soon, buddy. So let's talk the fact that, without a doubt, once again, it's not like this is a new storyline. Like, as Jays fans, it really does get old almost talking about how good the AL East is. But I feel like it's even been bumped a little higher this year, like, just with the start, how good Baltimore has looked, the fact that the Red Sox have not fallen on their face, like maybe some of us predicted they would. If anything, the Yankees are the big surprise. And even though they just have a pile of injuries, still are managing to kind of keep their head above water. Peter, would love to hear where you feel this division is going to shake out in the end. Do you still feel like the Yankees, because I know that was your original prediction, I could be wrong here. I remember watching Jay's Digest earlier in the offseason, and you had predicted Yankees probably winning the division. How are you feeling now?
Well, so this was before all their injuries happened. I had the Yankees, Jays, Rays, than Orioles and Red Sox. I did have the Red Sox finishing last. That's looking pretty good so far. They don't look to they looked like the odd man out there in the AL East. But right before the season started, Nick and I actually had a live stream the day before opening day, and we saw the Carlos Rodon injury, the Luis Severino injury. So I switched it up. I said the Jays are going to take the division, Yankees second, Rays third, and I still think it's going to turn out that way. I think the Rays are going to balance out right now. Let's look at who they played. They played the Nationals, the A's, the Tigers, the White Sox two times. And the two teams that they played that are above 500, and the Astros and the Blue Jays, they've lost both of those series. Now, I'm not saying they're not as good as those two teams, but I do think it'll balance itself out once their schedule starts to get harder. They lost Jeffrey Springs for the season as well, so that's going to be a tough blow for them. I think they're going to finish third. They're going to get that same wild card spot that they got last year. The Yankees, once they get healthy, probably have the best rotation in baseball apart from Atlanta Braves, and they're a force to be reckoned with. But right now, it's important that the Jays got off to a fast start that they have, and they can keep up with these teams early on, because that's the most important thing. Last year, they started off pretty slow. You let the Yankees get into a big lead, and it's too big of a hole to climb out of once it gets to crunch time towards the end of the season. So now's the time when you got to try to separate yourself from those other rivals while they're injured, while they're not at their peak form. And I think that's what the Jays are doing right now, and I do expect them to be at the top once it's all said and done.
Which is such a great point, Peter, when you talk about just getting off to a good start, which is something that the Jays have struggled with in the past. 18 and 10 right now. They're five games back of the Rays for the lead in the division. And I think sometimes people forget, five games feels like a ton, but the truth is it's not. We watched what happened with the Yankees last year. We've seen it time and time and time again. You can point to examples throughout the last few years in baseball of teams who have had big leads in April, and it dwindles away quickly. Juan, when you look at the AL East, who do you see as the top team? And do you believe in Baltimore enough that they will compete for a playoff spot this year?
Yeah, I think when I look at the AL East, I think, thank God that the Mariners are on the West Coast, for one. Holy cow, man. And the thing is, my younger brother Dallas, who played, is a big Rays fan, massive Rays fan. And it's really pissing me off this season. The start, 30, I think it was 13 straight to start. That was the worst opening day, 2 week stretch of my entire baseball fandom. It's wild. The East is wild. It's always been good. You know, the Blue Jays have never necessarily been bad. They've usually been behind, you know, a good Tampa Bay team that's making as much as Mike Trout, their entire roster, which is insane. And then the Yankees, Boston Red Sox are always going to feel a good team. So the Jays are in a tough division, but I think that you should never change it. I know some people talk about realigning the divisions to offer more competitiveness, but I think the AL East encapsulates, you know, America and baseball and everything you want in a division. It's competitive throughout. You play, you know, arguably the best teams, even the Red Sox being 15-14 right now. Do we know that they wouldn't be in first place in the West Division ahead of the Astros, who are maybe struggling a little bit, and the Rangers, who spent millions and millions of dollars, billions almost, if I'm not mistaken, you know, and then a team like Baltimore.
On shortstops alone.
Not shortstops alone. you know, it's wild to see, but it's very entertaining, and I think it's good for those major markets. You know, Toronto's got all of Canada, New York, Boston. Those are major sports markets. Baltimore's some of the most faithful fans when things are going well. And then, unfortunately, you know, Tampa's the best out of the five of them with the worst market of all of them, which is wild to see, you know, the lowest budget team. I think Baltimore is screwed just based off of who they got to play in their division when the games add up. You know, Tampa is going to be there. They're always there. You know, New York is going to be there, and the Blue Jays are going to be there. The Blue Jays have one of the best rosters in the MLB, in my opinion. You know, from top to bottom, there's, you know, you get a guy like Chapman, who is just the third base defensive guy, hitting 380. You know, it's tough to say where it's all going to shake out, and I think injuries are going to play a big part.
The Yankees have done a great job of overcoming that. And if they get healthy and stay healthy, that's going to be a tough team to beat. You know, you don't go 23-5 as Tampa Bay as a fluke. That's not a fluke, you know. And so we're dealing with those two teams.
Where are you at on that, Joel, when you look at this Tampa Bay Rays team and you see that 23-5 record? And I Juan makes a good point. You don't go 23-5 by fluke, but they can't keep that pace up, can they?
No, I don't think so, but like the a lot of the reasons the Rays haven't beaten teams that are over 500 is because they didn't get to be 500 teams because the Rays beat them before they ever had the chance, right? So it's just
it's a good point.
I feel like all of those teams, Baltimore, Boston, all of them have a chance of beating anybody else in the AL East, right? Like any series can go any way within the AL East. So what Tampa's doing by cleaning up everywhere else is what you have to do to win this division, right? Because we're going to be headbanging for 6 months against each other because we're all dominant, really good teams, you know, like there are stages. Baltimore and Boston may not be as good as Tampa, New York and Toronto, but any one of those teams can come in and beat anybody in any series, right? So to me, what Tampa is doing, taking care of business with everybody else, is what the team that does that best over 162 is probably going to take the division, because really dominating within the division is a really hard thing to ask for.
That's a great point, Joel. I don't know if Peter, when you were playing, it was the same thing, but my coach has always told me, take care of the games that you're expected to take care of. Win the games you're expected to win. And then if we go 50% on the other ones, we're going to be there at the end of the year. So
That's a skill in itself. And the Rays are so good at doing that. They're so fundamentally sound and they do all the little things right. I've been harping on it all year with the Toronto Blue Jays that I don't think they're in the top five teams or in the upper echelon teams just quite yet, because they do let those games squeak away that they should win, and they're not able to make those fundamental plays within those nine innings to maybe scratch out a run when their offense isn't going. So I think Tampa does all those things right. They don't let games slip away. Their bullpen is locked down. Their starting rotation is really good. It's just their offense. When they come up against a good pitcher, they're liable to get shut down. And we saw that, you know, Kevin Gausman, when he's in there against Tampa last year, he struck out 11 and shut them out at the Trump, which is something that we never see. We never see a Blue Jays pitcher go in there and shut out the Rays, but he went ahead and did that. And they came up against a tough Guardians team in the wild card series. They couldn't get anything done on the offensive end, and they got to stay healthy. They didn't have Wander Franco last year. Randy Arozarena wasn't himself. And if those guys can stay healthy, I do think they're a threat. And I do think they're probably the third best team in the division, but still give the edge to the Jays and the Yankees just based off talent alone and offensive ability.
The chat going pretty crazy here. Jason Austin says Rays are nine deep at starting pitcher and are playing their 40-man roster versus everyone else's 26-man roster, which just is about the most Rays thing possible. And he kind of nails it there. Chris says the Rays pitching has been injured and they're still red hot, worried about when Glasnow, Baz return. Worth worrying about, without a doubt. And I mean, we don't need to get too much into how amazing the Rays are, but one thing that just constantly blows my mind with that team is the fact that not only can they lose players constantly to other teams, but their scouting department, their player development departments are constantly losing the best to other organizations. Their management is constantly pilfered by other organizations, and it doesn't matter. You take something out and it doesn't matter whether it's that 40-man roster, whether it's the front office, whether it's their player development. The next year, they're just as good. And it is so annoying. And I think if anyone could actually pinpoint what they're doing right, there'd be more than one Tampa Bay Rays in professional sports. But yeah, they're an impressive organization.
And they transform guys too. They take, like, look at Jeffrey Springs. I'll use him as an example. He had a 7.5 ERA in Boston. He goes to Tampa Bay, a reclamation project, turns into a Cy Young candidate the next year. Then Drew Rasmussen, they get him in the Willy Adames trade. I wouldn't say he's an ace potential, but this guy would be a solid three on any rotation. And that's what they do. They take these guys, they just plug and play. They could take me and I'd have a four ERA tomorrow if they wanted. That's just the type of organization that they are. And it's so impressive. They churn out these guys and it's just awesome. You got to give them props with their limitations as well, right?
Truly, and the way that they use their limitations, they know their limitations, and then they work within them, right? Like, even if you look at the way that this Wander Franco deal was structured, right? Like, they locked up one of the best young shortstops in all of baseball long-term, and they did it in a way where it's backloaded. It's still going to be a very friendly contract by the time that he's probably priced out of their price range, and then they're going to be able to flip him with 4 years of control and get a insane package back. And this is just Rays 101. And again, just super impressive.
I think that's everything that the Athletics want to be and don't know how to. And so the Rays are setting records and Oakland is probably heading to Vegas. Like, that's the difference. And Oakland is a whole nother conversation, but I think so many teams want to be able to do what the Rays are doing and have been doing for better part of two decades. And it goes to show how difficult it is because they spend no money at all and they're always winning. You can lock them in for a playoff spot every year, regardless of the Rays are like the Bill Belichick of the NFL, where they'll sign a Walmart cashier to play slot wide receiver and go to the Super Bowl back in the Brady days. That's the best comparison I can think of.
All right, guys. Did anyone else have anything to add on the AL East here? Okay. So Juan, I know you got to get out of here. I will let you go, buddy. Before you do, Mustard Tiger in chat says, Juan, can you come and be a regular, please? So obviously you were enjoyed today. Thank you so much for your time, buddy. All the best. And we'll bug you to come back on the show later.
Absolutely, man. I'm always down to talk baseball. I do have to plug my comedy special for those who are watching, if they enjoyed what they heard out of me. I got a comedy special out. If you're in the US, it's on Amazon Prime. If you're in Canada, it's on YouTube. You can just search my name, Juan Forno, or search the Snow Mexican. I tour across North America and I love talking baseball. So if you know me from this podcast, come see me at a show. I'd love to catch up with you. And I do shows with Scott every once in a while as well. So those are always fun.
By the way, Juan is Canadian, everybody. I know he's living in Portland, but just to put the Snow Mexican album title in perspective. Yeah.
That's a good call, Scott.
All right, Juan. Take care, buddy.
Thanks, guys.
All right, have fun.
Meet you, Juan.
See you, Juan. Take care, man.
Okay. Now that we're down to three here, and before we call this thing, I do want to bring up this Mexico City series. I don't know if you gentlemen followed yesterday's game at all.
Yeah, I did.
The Padres and the Giants. Number one, very, very cool. MLB doing a great job of growing the game, having a series, major league regular season series in Mexico. I think it's about time. Very, very cool. But then they went and, again, everyone was talking about the heat, the air, whatever it is, the elevation, but it was a tinderbox in Mexico. They hit 11 home runs. They broke records for the amount of runs scored. Where are you guys at on just the idea? Let's really get into the weeds here, okay? Expansion is coming up. Mm-hmm. After watching this game in Mexico and the fans and how crazy it was and how cool it was, do you think Mexico City is a possibility for expansion, Joel? And what did you think of last night's game?
After the World Baseball Classic, I'm all like, I want international baseball. Like, the more of that I can see, the better. What do I feel about the Mexico series? It harkens back to, was it the Red Sox and the Yankees who went to England and had that absolutely balls out home run fest on each other like 2-3 years ago? You guys remember that? It also makes me think about these like specialty games and the issues with the Goldilocks balls and the like the balls, you know, being sent to specific places to, you know, we don't want to go to Mexico City and see a 1-0 pitcher's duel. So, you know, right. So it's just, it when these things happen, it, and Major League Baseball being kind of caught up in this situation of the balls being warped and sent to specific games, it definitely hits that part of my brain where I'm like, were you trying to create some fans here? Did you do something to those balls? The altitude, the all the other aspects of it was a, like you said, it was a tinderbox ready to see some offense go off. But man, that was something. That was how many home runs did they hit?
11. Yeah, I think it was 11.
11. Yeah, it was 11 yeah. home runs in that game. A 16-11 win for the Padres. Like, absolutely crazy. It's kind of funny here. New Brunswick, Canada guy says, do they have a humidor in Mexico City? LOL. Peter, what did you think of yesterday's game and just the idea of them playing some regular season games in Mexico in general?
It was great. It was great to see them go to Mexico. It's obviously such a huge baseball market, but it was too much. It was too much offense. It's like the best comparison I could give is like when you play MLB The Show and you play at Coors Field on like rookie difficulty. There's just home runs flying everywhere, and it was a joy to watch. Obviously, two fun teams, a pretty good rivalry with Tatis back in the fold. So it's great that those two teams are going at it in the Mexico series. And I think they should do more of this, not only in Mexico, in Japan as well. They should be doing that. Like Joel said, in England as well, they should get back to that. Try to grow the game as much as possible, because we saw what the World Baseball Classic did. There was no pitch clock. There were no modified rules, but everyone was locked in when push came to shove. And when Japan was playing at 5 a.m, there were people waking up to watch that. When USA was playing Great Britain, there was a record audience. So there's a market for baseball. You just got to tap into it and try to get into as many markets as possible. And I think this is a step in the right direction here.
Couldn't agree more. All right, gentlemen, let's get to your topic, Joel, here before we come to a close here. What are you bringing to the table for us to talk about today?
This was something we were talking about in our text chats. And it was just something I felt like bringing up. I know Adam had a really interesting opinion on it, but he's not here right now. But it was okay. So my idea is, in Major League Baseball, you've got two teams right now who have a captain. That's the Kansas City Royals and the New York Yankees. Aaron Judge and Salvador Perez are the captains of their respective teams. Now, Canada being a hockey synonymous culture, and all of our hockey teams have captains and assistant captains. I was starting to run through my mind. I'm like, do the Toronto Blue Jays fit the mold of being a team that has a team captain, right? Red Sox formerly have had team captains. It's not something that was just two teams. Some teams have brought in team captains over the years. But just to say, if my question is, if the Blue Jays were to create that, it's the idea that you have somebody to take onus when you win, the first guy to hold the trophy when you win. When you lose, he's the one who picks up the microphone and explains why. He's the guy who would hold the players only meeting, you know, if when things are going bad. So the idea is, if the Blue Jays were to have a team captain, who would you have it be just right now?
George Springer. It would have to be George Springer. He's the de facto leader on this team. He's a World Series MVP. He's everything that the Blue Jays could have hoped for when they went out and acquired him. Now, I know the injuries and I know that he hasn't always been available, but he's just such a good player. And I'm still amazed that he's on the Blue Jays. Like, it's still surreal to me that he is a Blue Jay after all of his success that he had in Houston. And I wouldn't call him a generational player, but one of my friends asked me, and I remember this, when the Blue Jays signed him, and I tried to give him an NBA comparison. I don't know if you guys follow the NBA, but I said, it's like if Jimmy Butler came to the Raptors, in a sense.
Great example.
And I just think he brings so much to the table, like the intangibles, and he's just such a great personality, such a great personality off the field as well. And he is a guy that can get you over the hump. And I was really bummed out when he got hurt in the playoffs last year, because I told my friends, I told people that were watching my channel at the time, although it was fairly smaller than it is now, I told them, once we get to the playoffs, George Springer is going to be the best player on this team. And he was for the better part of game one. He's the only one that did anything in that game against Seattle. Truly. And then in game two, it all fell apart. We don't have to tell that story again. But I truly believe that if he was in there and if his presence was still out on that field, that the Jays might have been able to muster up something after blowing that lead to Seattle.
I'm not going to vary from what either you are saying. I think it has to be Springer. I know the chat is pretty much on board with that. Chapman, probably the other option there. When you watch these guys in the dugout and just who you can tell the leaders are, I feel like it is Chappie and Springer are kind of the dudes that the younger players are drawn to and are going to talk to. And if there was a C, I think it's got to go to Springer. And I feel very similar to how you do, Peter, just with, I still watch him play and I'm like, I can't believe he's a Blue Jay. Yeah. Like, it's just, it puts a smile on my face. It's just, and it's so cool to see how hard this front office worked this year to try and make sure to give him the most opportunity to be on the field as much as possible. I think that as much That's right. as improving the outfield defense, which was obviously paramount to this front office, getting Springer out of center field and giving him more time in right and more time at DH was obviously one of their priorities, and it's working out. It's working out. And I mean, fingers crossed, knock on all the wood in the world, but yeah, Georgie's our captain in my opinion. And still just love seeing him in that Blue Jays uniform. All right. So we're going to go to my topic before we close this thing off. It's not really probably going to take us much time, but I do want to touch on Drew Maggi with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Oh. The fact that he got his first major league hit and his first RBI yesterday. This is a dude who is pushing 1,200 innings in minor league ball. He's been a professional baseball player for 13 years, and at 33 years old, finally gets the call up to the major leagues. Just a feel-good story. Feel free either of you to jump in and just comment on this a little.
Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, great story. That's what you work for your whole life. And I'll use another NBA reference here. It's like when Andre Ingram got called up by the Lakers in that final game and he went off for those 20 points. He has gray hairs for God's sake, and he's going out there and he's giving the work to these NBA guys. And it's just what you work for your whole life. And to see them grind it out and ride the bus in the minor leagues and then finally get the call, it's just a special moment. And he's 33 years old. I'm sure he's such a great locker room presence for the AAA ball club that Pittsburgh has. But once he got that call, he was like a 10-year-old kid who made the elite travel ball team for the first time. You know, it's just a different set of emotions that he's displaying. And it's great. Just as not even as a Jays fan, just as a baseball fan in general, you love to see things like that. You love to see it.
Peter, did you see the video of the manager for the AAA team kind of doing the spiel and then eventually
I did.
I love that video. I love that video for a few reasons. Number one, I love it just because the way the manager really drew it out. I also loved that he did not expect it to be him at all. In fact, you even got the feeling he was barely paying attention to the spiel he was giving. Even
like, it was just How many times had it happened that he's been in the room for somebody else?
Yeah. Oh, that's true. That's a good point. That's a good point.
So at that point, I wouldn't expect to be called either. You know, the other great thing is the fact that Pittsburgh's actually awesome this year. So it's not like you're not being called up to 10 and 36 Pittsburgh and it doesn't mean anything. Like he's playing in important games in Pittsburgh for the first time in
how long? Winning team.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So it's just like, it's the Cinderella team and the Cinderella story player together, which just makes it like,
how can, with all the things that happened bad for the Pittsburgh Pirates, when something good happens, I don't think anybody's sitting there being like, damn, those Pirates. I wish they were shit again for 30 straight years. No, like they're kind of like a, you know, they're this team that you can, they might not be your team, but when they do something right, you're like, finally, those fans there deserve something to cheer for. And this is something all of a sudden we're all cheering for. Like you said, it's all in baseball.
Yeah.
I mean,
It's like in Field of Dreams when Moonlight Graham got his at bat there and then he became a doctor again. It's like, it's like that, you know? Yeah. I might have to watch it again too, because I'm feeling nostalgic now, but it's like that. And he said it himself in the movie. Obviously it's make believe and it's satire in a sense, but he said, I just want to stare down that pitcher and let him know that I'm there. And I'm sure that's exactly what Drew Maggie was feeling. You just want to be there, and it's a thrill, and you know that you belong because you worked your whole life to get there, and I'm sure it's just a special moment.
I know Chad is feeling the same way here. Taco Time says, hard not to love that story. Hit an RBI as well. Chris says he can say he was an MLB player now for the rest of his life. Have to love it for him. Amazing story. Michelle Marie Beer says, to see anyone realize their dreams, even if it's just for a single series, is beautiful. And then she sums it up so perfectly, which is how we'll end this episode. She says, how can you not be romantic about baseball, right? Gentlemen, thank you so, so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Peter, we're going to have to bug you to come back because this was too enjoyable not to.
It was great.
Really enjoy your podcast. Everybody out here listening right now, if you haven't checked out Blue Jays Digest, do so. Peter, if you can give them where to find this.
Yeah, it's Jays Digest on YouTube, so go ahead and check that out. Blue Jays Digest YT on Twitter. Go and follow us there. We don't post much on there, but we do post every day on YouTube. So if you do want your daily fix of Blue Jays baseball, and we do keep up to date with the major leagues as well, you can go ahead and subscribe to us. We got you covered. We have pregame shows for the Blue Jays games. We have post-game reaction videos and news videos sprinkled in every now and then, but this was a ton of fun, and I just want to thank you both for having me on. I had a great time, and I'd be glad to do this. I'm going to be playing basketball on Sundays now from 3 to 6 Eastern time, so might be a little bit tight, but maybe you could squeeze me in there a little bit later. Yeah. I'd love to.
Sounds good, Peter. We'd love to join you sometime too if you ever need a guest. Joel,
for sure,
my man, our regular. Hey, call me on TikTok.
It's usually over my shoulder, but I'm not at home.
What do you got going on here, bud? Tell us where you're at.
Yeah, the script is with Happy Madison. We've had some talks for the last 10 days, and it's been really, really good. They love it. I'm talking about my Tommy John script for the people in the chat and people watching. I got my script to Adam Sandler and Happy Madison. They're seemingly really interested in telling this story, and their production company has kind of taken a shift towards these types of narratives in the last few years. So I'm really excited to be in the door with them. All my stuff over at Hey Commie on TikTok, you can Hey_Commie. Also, we've got a group of guys together down in the States called Armchair Baseball, which is also on TikTok. And that's just more of a general baseball. It's not specifically Blue Jays, but some of the guys that have been come on the walk off provide videos for it. That's a daily dose of baseball. And Rick talks baseball. Jack and Rick have both been on the walk off, so they contribute videos too. But it's just kind of a group of content creators coming together and under one umbrella. That's what that would be. So that's Armchair Baseball on TikTok, and then me, I'm Hey Call Me on TikTok. That's where you can find me. So, and it's just always a pleasure, Scott. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Gentlemen, thanks again. Really enjoyed this. To everyone in chat, to everyone watching, we had up to almost 75 viewers throughout this thing. So thank you so very, very much. We'll see everyone here. You can, of course, see us. Our next walk-off episode is going to be Tuesday, the mailbag. So get your questions in. You can do so on Twitter at Walk-Off Podcast or on Instagram, the Walk-Off Podcast. Take care, everybody. Cheers. We'll see you all later. Gentlemen, I got to text Adam to let him stop the stream. So feel free to just hit leave and call it a night. All the best, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Take care.
Nice to meet you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Osmer with a drive. Cheese and cracker chose to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.